You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor, read by April Lee. This is being recorded on November 11, 2024. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. First, Trump is back. Parents worldwide, hope and fear for children's futures. By Ryan Lenora Brown, Whitney Ulick, Khada Abdul-Fattah, Dina Kraft, Fred Weir, Dominique Soguel, and Anne Scott Tyson. Second, Circling the Drain, How One Georgia Veteran Fought Off Homelessness, by Patrick Johnson. Third, Donald Trump's New White House Begins to Take Shape, by Thomas Beaumont. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Trump is back. Parents worldwide, hope and fear for children's futures. By Ryan Lenora Brown, staff writer, Whitney Ulick, special correspondent, Khada Abdul-Fattah, special contributor, Dina Kraft, special correspondent, Fred Weir, special correspondent, Dominique Soguel, special correspondent, and Anne Scott Tyson, staff writer. November 8, 2024, 2:17 p.m. ET, Johannesburg, Mexico City, Al Zawaida, Gaza, Tel Aviv, Israel, Moscow, Basel, Switzerland, and Yan'an, China. On Wednesday, November 6, Donald Trump declared victory in the U.S. presidential election, and in a tent camp for migrants in Mexico City, a Venezuelan boy named Yorhan turned 7 years old. Neither knew of the other's special day, but Mr. Trump's victory means their lives are now intertwined. Yorhan and his family are trying to cross the U.S. border, the same one the president-elect has promised to seal when he takes office in January. Yorhan was blissfully unaware of that pledge as he excitedly accepted a wedge of vanilla birthday cake laced with icing squiggles from a volunteer. But sitting beside him was his mother, Yohani, whose eyes pricked with tears. So much, from the economic collapse that caused them to flee Venezuela to the rats scurrying through their tent, felt out of her control as a mother. And now this. My fear now is that the U.S. president won't receive us, she says, that Trump will send us back to the jungle. Every 4 years, Americans choose who will fill the world's most powerful office, and this year, they've selected a leader who touts as one of his greatest foreign policy strengths his unpredictability. At a time of broad global conflict with mass human migration, major wars in the Middle East and Europe, and China jockeying to surpass the United States as the world's superpower, Mr. Trump's America First mantra will bend the arc of the world's future. Political leaders and foreign diplomats are on alert. But this week, it was parents around the world who absorbed the news of Mr. Trump's victory with particular immediacy. Some feel that an American, quote, strongman could finally put an end to the instability that has shadowed their children's prospects. Others feel his erratic approach to global affairs has the potential to upend their dreams. Sometimes you pay for problems that aren't yours, says Yohani, whose last name we are withholding for her security. I die 100 times a day. As the sun dipped below the horizon on American Election Day, casting long shadows over a tent camp in central Gaza, Sossin Swirky's heart broke again. She wasn't thinking of Mr. Trump or Democratic candidate Kamala Harris, but of Musa. 1 year to the day earlier, her 16-year-old son had walked out of the gates of Al-Quds Hospital in Gaza City, where the family was sheltering from Israeli airstrikes. In his hurry to get to safety, Musa left his beloved rescue cat, Mishmish, at home. Now, as the bombs fell and the sirens wailed, he couldn't bear the thought of Mishmish scared and alone, looking for his master in the rubble. So Musa and his cousin decided to go back to find him. The bomb struck them on their way. Onlookers carried the severely wounded boy back to the hospital, where he died in front of his mother's eyes. "Now," she says, "I die 100 times a day." But as she listened to news about the American election results, a single hope pushed its way through her grief. Maybe Mr. Trump could end the war that had so far killed at least 42,000 Palestinians. "I wish he would bring a ceasefire that would allow Palestinians to return home," she says. She knew that plenty of people thought it was possible. Mr. Trump had told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that he wanted an end to hostilities before his inauguration day, according to Israeli media. Far from those backroom negotiations, Ms. Swerki was simply desperate to keep her family alive. She longed to see one of her daughters, who lived on the other side of an Israeli checkpoint. And every day, she feared another of her 9 children might die doing something ordinary, like collecting water. Waiting for Mr. Trump's next move, she revisited her memories of Musa, the boy who loved okra with beef, had an incredible laugh, and died for the love of an innocent. In her grief, she hoped only that the next American president would make sure no parent in the world sees what I have seen. He says he wants to make peace. 396 days. That was how long it had been on American election day since the last time Idit Ohel had seen her son, Alon. That October evening, he sat at the family piano in a village in northern Israel, his fingers gliding across the keyboard as he played a popular Israeli song about longing. Nothing suggested it was the eve of the family's greatest nightmare. But early the next morning, on October 7, 2023, Hamas militants stormed the Nova Music Festival, where Alon, 22 years old and an aspiring jazz pianist, had gone with his friends. They dragged him by his curly hair, tossing him into a pickup truck with others he had been sheltering with, and drove them into Gaza. Since then, Miss Ohel's life has been consumed by a single thought. Alon must live. And for Alon to live, the war must end. By American Election Day, her son had become a familiar face to Israelis, his image plastered on posters across the country, along with others taken captive that day, and carried through the streets in mass protests. The Israeli government's failure to return him and the other hostages wasn't just a reminder of the country's most catastrophic intelligence failure or the war it had sparked. It was also a challenge to a fundamental covenant of Israeli society. Leave no one behind. Miss Ohel never had much interest in politics, seeing herself as merely a person interested in doing good in the world, she says. But now she had no choice but to care, because her child's life depended on the choices of politicians. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu remains steely in his resolve to fight in Gaza until what he calls total victory. But like Ms. Werke, Ms. Ohel saw hope in Mr. Trump, though it was a faint one. He wasn't a man who took no for an answer, He projected aggression and power. He says he wants to make peace here, she says, her voice soft and exhausted. Maybe, she thought, that would be enough to finally bring Alon home. Two Mothers, One Wish. Marina also knows what it is like to live in the unspeakable space between your child's life and their death. In March 2022, her son, Volodya, abruptly stopped calling. At the time, he was a junior intelligence officer serving in the Russian army in the Russian-occupied Donbas region of Ukraine. When she stopped hearing from him, Marina, a real estate agent whom we are calling by a pseudonym for her security, first approached the local military office. It didn't have an answer, so she went to Moscow, and then to Donbas itself. There, she traveled from town to town with a photo of Volodya, clean-shaven and baby-faced, barely out of his teens, asking every soldier she met if they had seen him. Each no ached, but it also gave her hope that he was out there somewhere, perhaps captured by the Ukrainians, but still breathing. Then, in early 2024, she received a notification from the army. Volodya's remains had been identified. He died a hero, she was told, but the platitudes felt hollow. This hell is over for me now, but so many other mothers are still going through it, Marina says. On the campaign trail, Mr. Trump pledged repeatedly that as president, he would end Marina's war in 24 hours. Julia Kozak wants her war to end, too. The Ukrainian mother was 7 months pregnant when Russia invaded her country. She was on vacation at that time, and her flight home was canceled. So she flew to Zurich, where she had a friend who could give her a place to stay. Today, her daughter, Dana, is growing up like any other Swiss suburban child in Basel now, splashing around in toddler swim classes and speaking to her mother in a babbling mix of English and Ukrainian. Ms. Kozak is grateful Dana's first memories won't be of hearing air raid sirens and hiding in basements, but she also cannot help but long for the life they do not have. Just before she left Kyiv, she had bought an apartment there where she imagined she would raise her daughter in comfort, surrounded by friends and family, not as a refugee in a foreign land. Watching the American election results this week, she felt conflicted. While she likes the Democrats, they were unable to stop the war or help Ukraine win it. Mr. Trump strikes her as a crazy person, but his unusual methods might just be her country's best hope now. He wants to be a hero, and if he does stop the Ukraine war, then he will be a hero. Marina, who this spring held Volodya's funeral in the same church where she had brought him to be baptized 2 decades earlier, is silent when asked if the American president-elect can usher in peace. Finally, she says, I've always believed that everybody needs to sit down at the negotiating table and put a stop to this slaughter. If this Trump can do that, I will support it. Peace above all. Indeed, Mr. Trump promised in his victory speeches that he would make the world a more peaceful place. I'm not going to start a war, I'm going to stop the wars, he proclaimed. Those words brought comfort to Li Zandong. Though he has never lived through war himself, he too knows its costs. Like other Chinese of his generation, the 44-year-old music teacher was raised by relatives who had survived 2 violent conflicts, the Japanese occupation around World War II, and then the Chinese Civil War just after it. His grandfather barely eked out a living from tiny terraced fields in the drought and famine-prone hills of China's northwest Shanxi province. His parents, meanwhile, grew up in the turbulent aftermath of the 1949 Communist Revolution. Hunger and political unrest hanging low over their childhoods, too. By contrast, Mr. Lee was born at a moment when China was stabilizing and flinging itself open to the world. That allowed him to study music education at secondary school, a level of learning his parents couldn't dream of. His own children have done even better. His eldest son is now 20 and a university student in a technical field. Lately, however, the peace that made all this possible has begun to feel precarious to Mr. Lee. Amid growing U.S.-China tensions, the Chinese military was stepping up operations around Taiwan, the self-governing island of 23 million people across the Taiwan Strait that Beijing claims sovereignty over. A war for Taiwan would ensnare the U.S., too, and so much depended on the American president-elect, a man who often seemed to despise China, but also promised geopolitical pragmatism. That is the best, Mr. Lee says. If there was one thing he knew intimately, after all, it was how much depended on peace. A time of rumor. In Mexico City, Yohani spent much of Johan's birthday listening to post-election rumors whistle through the migrant camp at warp speed. People spoke of mass deportations, of the border closing. Yohani didn't know what was true, but she was shaken. In July, she and her husband made the painful choice to leave home so that her children could have a future, she says. They made a journey she would never wish on any child, walking hungry through jungles that echoed with the howls of wild animals to end up here. And now it felt like it was all at risk. As she spoke, Johan reappeared, rosy-cheeked with damp hair, after a shower he cheerfully described as freezing cold. He wore a new hoodie, plucked from a table of donated clothes. He had chosen the red, white, and blue uniform of Captain America. Special correspondent Taylor Luck contributed to this report. Circling the Drain, How One Georgia Veteran Fought Off Homelessness, by Patrick Johnson, staff writer, November 11, 2024, 5 a.m. ET. As a master carpenter, form setter, concrete finisher, block mason, and bricklayer, Thomas Hilado, now in his early 60s, feels stable and confident. "You name it, I can build you a house," says Mr. Hilado, a former 82nd Airborne Division heavy drop rigging specialist. But just a few months ago, Mr. Hilado was about to lose his own home. In a poignant example of how small steps often lead to big leaps even on chronic nationwide problems, local efforts around the country are addressing the scourge of homelessness among people like Mr. Hilado by combining Veterans Affairs outreach with local resources and the perseverance of veterans themselves. For Mr. Hilado, that local help came just in the nick of time. His rent had nearly doubled overnight on his rented duplex in a gritty corner of Athens, Georgia. His fingers were so gnarled from a life of hard labor that he could no longer hold the tools to build a replacement, even if he had the resources. Worse, he had sold off all his tools and a prized golf club set to subsidize his modest railroad pension from a career driving spikes as a track man. After rent and bills, he says he had $4 to feed himself for the month and nothing left to sell. "I was circling the drain," he says. "I was ready to give up." Repair what's broken. In 2023, the total number of homeless American veterans was 35,574, an increase of 7.4% over the year before. Another 1.4 million other veterans across the country, like Mr. Hilado, are considered at risk of homelessness or living in unsafe surroundings. Homeless can mean the former soldier is squatting or couch surfing. Unsheltered means that person lives in a tent or on a park bench. After California, Georgia has the highest percentage of homeless veterans who are entirely unsheltered. 404 out of 701, according to research by the nonprofit group Mission Roll Call. To be sure, the number of homeless veterans dropped by more than half between 2010 and 2020. But an uptick in recent years has sparked new funding and efforts by the Department of Veterans Affairs, including a one-team approach inspired mainly by successes in New Orleans. Starting in 2014, under Mayor Mitch Landrieu, the city reduced its number of homeless veterans to functional zero by requiring any veteran living on the street or in abandoned housing to be placed in permanent housing within 30 days unless they actively refuse to go. Today, the VA One Team Program, a strategy of activating local resources that brings together housing, employment, and outreach workers for each former service member, has also proven effective at coordinating support for veterans, especially those living outside or under bridges. Last year, the VA district that covers the Central Savannah River Valley helped 172 veterans find or stay in homes, almost three times the goal. Two of the former soldiers lost their homes during the year, but their caseworkers were able to find them new housing. The region currently has just about 25 veterans either completely homeless or at severe risk of becoming homeless. What we have seen is a housing crisis, a rent increase, and people barely making ends meet now struggling even more, says Sabrina Faircloth, a VA caseworker. Sometimes veterans are afraid to advocate for themselves with a landlord, afraid that they'll return to homelessness. So we help them truly rebuild their lives and learn how to talk to folks and, if needed, repair relationships that are broken. As he reflects on Veterans Day this year, Mr. Hilado says that his path to a secure home is hardly a simple one of government bureaucracy swooping in to help. In fact, before finding out about a VA housing program, he fought on several fronts, even petitioning the mayor of Athens to fight the rent hike, with no success. But a case manager approached him recently while he was getting medical treatment from the VA. Not long after that, he moved to a brand new unit nearby. Thanks to a federal housing subsidy set aside for veterans, Mr. Hilado now pays just over $400 a month in rent, which, after bills, leaves him over $500 a month for food and sundries. "I can handle that," he says. Why some soldiers go unhoused. Like many homeless veterans, Mr. Hilado has known rough patches. He describes how, at 11, he was taken from his dad's home after his father, a prize-winning boxer, pummeled him so hard that the police were called. After years in foster care, he joined the Army, spending his tour starting in 1978 largely at Fort Bragg, now Fort Liberty, in Fayetteville, North Carolina. "Cold War, baby," he says of the era. Given his own struggles back then and beyond, Mr. Hilado understands why veteran homelessness remains a stubborn problem in the U.S. A slightly larger percentage of veterans are homeless than of the general population. "Some of those guys want to be homeless," says Mr. Hilado. They don't want to be productive members of society. For some, it's mental. For some, it's PTSD, he says. And it's hard for those kinds of people to trust anybody because nobody has been helping them for years. So when someone all of a sudden says, "We're going to help you," they say, "Leave me alone." But, he says, "I got desperate." As he heads into Veterans Day, Mr. Hilado says he has felt that the last year's stress fade as he enjoys a brand new apartment unit. His financial problems are finally in the rearview mirror. If you help yourselves and reach out to the right people, you'll get the help, he says. But you've got to put some groundwork in yourself. It's not going to magically appear with a Santa Claus present floating down to your house. Donald Trump's new White House begins to take shape. Among Donald Trump's picks for key roles in his second administration are Susie Wiles for Chief of Staff, Elise Stefanik for United Nations Ambassador, and Tom Homan and Stephen Miller for a pair of roles that will include immigration enforcement. By Thomas Beaumont, Associated Press, November 11, 2024, 2:48 p.m. ET. President-elect Donald Trump is starting to fill key posts in his second administration, putting an emphasis so far on aides and allies who were his strongest backers during the 2024 campaign. Here's a look at who he selected so far. Susie Wiles, Chief of Staff. Ms. Wiles was a senior advisor to Mr. Trump's 2024 presidential campaign and its de facto manager. Ms. Wiles has a background in Florida politics. She helped Ron DeSantis win his first race for Florida governor. 6 years later, she was key to Mr. Trump's defeat of him in the 2024 Republican primary. Ms. Wiles' hire was Mr. Trump's first major decision as president-elect, and one that could be a defining test of his incoming administration, considering her close relationship with the president-elect. Ms. Wiles is said to have earned Mr. Trump's trust in part by guiding what was the most disciplined of Mr. Trump's three presidential campaigns. Ms. Wiles was able to help keep Mr. Trump on track as few others have, not by criticizing his impulses, but by winning his respect by demonstrating his success after taking her advice. Tom Homan, Border Czar. Mr. Homan has been tasked with Mr. Trump's top priority of carrying out the largest deportation operation in the nation's history. Mr. Homan, who served under Mr. Trump in his first administration leading U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, was widely expected to be offered a position related to the border, an issue Mr. Trump made central to his campaign. Though Mr. Homan has insisted such a massive undertaking would be humane, he has long been a loyal supporter of Mr. Trump's policy proposals, suggesting at a July conference in Washington that he would be willing to run the biggest deportation operation this country's ever seen. Democrats have criticized Mr. Homan for his defending Mr. Trump's zero-tolerance policy on border crossings during his first administration, which led to the separation of thousands of parents and children seeking asylum at the border. Elise Stefanik, United Nations Ambassador. Ms. Stefanik is a representative from New York and one of Mr. Trump's staunchest defenders going back to his first impeachment. Elected to the House in 2014, Ms. Stefanik was selected by her GOP House colleagues as House Republican Conference Chair in 2021, when former Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney was removed from the post after publicly criticizing Mr. Trump for falsely claiming he won the 2020 election. Ms. Stefanik has served in that role ever since as the third-ranking member of House leadership. Ms. Stefanik's questioning of university presidents over anti-Semitism on their campuses helped lead to two of those presidents resigning, further raising her national profile. If confirmed, she would represent American interests at the UN as Mr. Trump vows to end the war waged by Russia against Ukraine, begun in 2022. He has also called for peace as Israel continues its offensive against Hamas in Gaza and its invasion of Lebanon to target Hezbollah. Stephen Miller, Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy. Mr. Miller, an immigration hardliner, was a vocal spokesperson during the presidential campaign for Mr. Trump's priority of mass deportations. Mr. Miller was a senior advisor during Mr. Trump's first administration. Mr. Miller has been a central figure in some of Mr. Trump's policy decisions, notably his move to separate thousands of immigrant families. Mr. Trump argued throughout the campaign that the nation's economic, national security, and social priorities could be met by deporting people who are in the United States illegally. Since Mr. Trump left office in 2021, Mr. Miller has served as the president of America First Legal, an organization made up of former Trump advisors aimed at challenging the Biden administration, media companies, universities, and others over issues such as free speech and national security. This story was reported by the Associated Press. Democrats begin soul-searching and finger-pointing after devastating loss. By Cameron Joseph, staff writer, November 8, 2024, 9:10 a.m. ET, Washington. It's the inflation, stupid. As divided and demoralized Democrats sift through the ashes of the 2024 election map, most agree on 2 points. Vice President Kamala Harris was fighting strong headwinds when it came to how voters felt about the cost of living. And her inability to convince enough voters that she could do a better job than Donald Trump on the economy cost her the election. 2/3 of voters rated the economy poorly, according to exit polls. President-elect Trump won them 70% to 28%. Nearly half of all voters said their family's financial situation was worse today than 4 years ago, and they backed Mr. Trump 81% to 17%. And less well-off voters were more likely to swing to Mr. Trump. In 2020, he lost voters who made less than $50,000 by 10 points. This year, according to exit polls, he lost them by just 1 point. He lost voters who make between $50,000 and $100,000 by 15 points in 2020, and won them this election. The only group that moved toward Ms. Harris was voters who make six-figure incomes. She won them by 5 points this year, after President Joe Biden lost them by 12 points in 2020. Democrats are uniformly alarmed that working-class voters who once made up the core of the Democratic base continue to abandon the party in droves. But they don't agree on why that happened, with some pointing to a failure to focus enough on pocketbook issues and soaking the rich, while others slam tin-eared and sometimes condescending messaging from a professional class dominated by white college graduates. Working-class voters vote more on their perceived economic self-interest than abstract debates over things like democracy, says Jeff Hauser, a Democratic strategist and former spokesperson for the AFL-CIO, the largest union federation in the United States. Unfortunately, Democrats ran a campaign that, in their national message, was predominantly about abstract concerns like democracy, and less about the economy. The biggest disagreement among Democrats isn't about the national headwinds. It's whether Ms. Harris and the party could have made major strategic decisions in the race's closing months to prevail anyway. Some are griping that the party didn't message effectively enough on the economy and took for granted Hispanic voters until it was too late. They are also debating whether they fundamentally have too many college-educated liberal white people who come off as insincere when talking to blue-collar voters of all ethnic backgrounds. I think we've done a lot to demonstrate that we're a party largely of white elites, says Democratic strategist Andy Barr, who pointed to issues like student loan forgiveness as a way to alienate blue-collar voters. Most people in this country don't go to college, and we sort of act as if they do. Most Latinos in this country aren't fixated on immigration policy, and we sort of act as if they are, he says. We're running campaigns that sort of serve us and our interests, and not the people we say we're running to represent. One former Biden White House strategist, who asked that they not be named in order to speak candidly, said the party needs to do some deep soul-searching about why Latinos and working-class voters of all stripes decided that Mr. Trump was their best bet economically. Democrats are going to need to take some time to analyze, to rethink the way we engage voters, and talk about policies, and talk about our accomplishments, they said. The party does need to tackle that issue head-on. It's probably the most important thing for the rebirth of the Democratic Party. Democrats may simply have forgotten Maslow's hierarchy of needs. People prioritize basic needs first. Finances, stability, safety, and subordinate everything else if those primary issues aren't addressed. Inflation, illegal immigration, and crime, all of which spiked in the first few years of the Biden-Harris administration coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic before dipping over the past year, were more salient and immediate to many voters than issues like protecting democracy or abortion access. Nearly one-third of voters who believe abortion should be legal in all or most cases voted for Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump even won some voters who admitted they didn't like him and worried about his policy views. By a 10-point margin, voters said he's too extreme, while a narrow majority of voters said Ms. Harris wasn't. Of the 53% of voters who hold an unfavorable view of him, 9% voted for him anyway. Strong economy, but high prices. The unemployment rate is hovering at historic lows, and the stock market has boomed. But rent and groceries are still expensive, and that hurts a lot more for voters with limited means. Some leading figures on the left are now saying Democrats lost because they didn't do enough to fix it. It should come as no surprise that a Democratic Party which has abandoned working-class people would find that the working class has abandoned them, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said in a post-election statement. First, it was the white working class, and now it is Latino and Black workers as well. While the Democratic leadership defends the status quo, the American people are angry and want change. And they're right. But around the globe, voters have punished incumbent parties on the left, right, and center for inflation, which was fueled by pandemic-driven supply chain interruptions and Russia's invasion of Ukraine, as well as massive government spending that many countries undertook to keep their economies afloat during the depths of the COVID-19 shutdown and its aftermath. A Financial Times analysis found that in all 10 developed countries that have held elections this year, the governing party did worse than in the previous race, the first time this has ever happened. In fact, Democrats saw their vote share drop by a smaller amount than other ruling parties. Still, U.S. voters clearly weren't happy with the state of things. A majority, 59%, disapproved of Mr. Biden, including 45% who strongly disapproved. Ms. Harris, as his vice president, had an albatross around her neck the whole campaign. One challenge was that many of Democrats' economic achievements were tucked into sprawling packages, with benefits that were only going to emerge in the long run or were already being phased out. The bipartisan infrastructure bill is just getting shovel-ready projects going. The Biden administration passed a hard cap on out-of-pocket Medicare spending, which will save money for a lot of older adults, but it doesn't kick in until 2025. The $3,600 child tax credits that were included in their 2021 pandemic relief package helped pull millions of children out of poverty, but expired after 1 year, which left families feeling, rightly, like they suddenly had less money now. Even President Biden acknowledged that on Thursday, saying the vast majority of the good economic work his administration had done for the economy won't be felt for years, with policies and projects only now just really kicking in. The Biden factor, a deep hole. And even if there were an economic record to sell, many Democrats gripe that they didn't have a candidate who could sell it for the past few years. As President Biden became more visibly frail, his staff limited his public appearances, turning down even traditional layups like the pre-Super Bowl interview. His disastrous June debate eventually forced him out of the race, leaving Ms. Harris just 107 days to build a presidential campaign and define herself to voters. David Plouffe, Ms. Harris's top advisor, posted on the social media platform X that the campaign had dug out of a deep hole, an implicit criticism of Mr. Biden. There are some signs that the Harris campaign's ad messaging and ground game actually did make a difference, even though it wasn't enough. She lost far less ground compared with in the 2020 election in the swing states where she campaigned than she did in the rest of the country. Milwaukee County, which includes the city and some inner suburbs, was the rare place where Mr. Trump only improved on his 2020 margins by 1 point. Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, Charlotte, moved just 2 points to the right, as did Fulton County, Georgia, which includes much of Atlanta. But the shift toward Mr. Trump was much more dramatic in some major metro areas that the campaigns didn't seriously contest. Miami-Dade County moved 19 points toward Mr. Trump, who became the first Republican presidential candidate to carry it since 1988. In New York City, where most of the vote has been counted as of Thursday, Ms. Harris was winning by a 38-point margin, down from Mr. Biden's 54-point margin 4 years ago. Cook County, Illinois, Chicago shifted 11 points toward Mr. Trump. Some of Ms. Harris's approach had similar problems as Mr. Biden's. Her pledge to incentivize home builders to increase housing supply, for instance, was long-term and abstract and wouldn't do anything for people whose rent has spiked in recent years. And some Democrats expressed frustration that her campaign hadn't stuck with populist messaging that Mr. Trump was a lackey for big business. She spent much of the end of the race focused on Mr. Trump as a threat to democracy, including in her closing argument speech on the National Mall. Mr. Trump's economic messaging seemed to be particularly successful with Hispanic voters. Exit polls showed Mr. Trump carrying 45% of the Hispanic vote nationally, a 13-point jump from his 2020 performance and the high water mark for any Republican presidential candidate in more than a half century. The only other Republican who has topped 40% of the Hispanic vote since the TV networks began conducting exit polls in 1972 was George W. Bush in 2004. Attack ad on transgender treatments. It's impossible to know how this race would have played out if Mr. Biden had decided not to run after the 2022 midterms and allowed Democrats to hold a primary for the nomination. Few Democrats would have struggled as much to get distance from the Biden administration as his number two. On the other hand, a primary could have led to a repeat of the 2019 contest, in which Democratic candidates were forced to the left on a bevy of issues by activist groups, and where some of Ms. Harris's most damaging comments, which were later resurrected in attack ads by the Trump campaign, were made. The Trump campaign spent the most money on an ad showing a clip of Ms. Harris promising to provide incarcerated transgender people access to gender-affirming care treatments. Democrats acknowledged that ad and a follow-up ad featuring popular black radio host Charlemagne the God slamming her for the comments on his show did serious damage to her, convincing some swing voters that she was dangerously liberal, as the ad said. According to an analysis shared by Ms. Harris's leading super PAC with the New York Times, that spot shifted the race 2.7 percentage points toward Mr. Trump after viewers watched it. The tagline, "Kamala Harris is for they, them. Donald Trump is for you," emphasized that she was focused on the wrong issues. While Mr. Trump appeared on scores of podcasts with large audiences of young men, Ms. Harris largely avoided them. Multiple Democrats faulted Ms. Harris for not accepting popular podcast host Joe Rogan's invitation to come to his Austin, Texas studio for an interview. Mr. Rogan, who leans right but holds fairly heterodox political views, interviewed Mr. Trump and endorsed him on the election's eve. Democrats don't all agree on what went wrong and whether Ms. Harris really stood a chance at fixing things, but they all agree that something needs to change. There are a lot of folks that look at how Democrats are portrayed and say, "They care about all these other things, but they don't care about what's going on in my life," says Democratic strategist Rodel Molyneux. There is a large chasm between what Democrats in Washington, D.C. think they are and what they stand for, and what the American people perceive them to be and what they stand for, and that's what we have to address. The Berlin Wall fell 35 years ago. Young East Germans fall for relics of the time. By Lenora Chu, Special Correspondent. November 8, 2024, 9:23 a.m. ET, Dresden and Bautzen, Germany. For most people, a fork is just a fork. But when Olivia Schneider spears a stalk of asparagus, she prefers the plastic-handled type dating back to the Communist German Democratic Republic, GDR. It's the kind of cutlery her East German grandparents eagerly trashed back in 1989 after the fall of the Berlin Wall, 35 years ago, this weekend. Finally, decades of austerity fell away, and Grandpa and Grandma Schneider set their hearts on filling their house with really nice West German stuff, explains Ms. Schneider. That's how her grandparents found themselves at one of many impromptu parking lot markets that had popped up, only to be cheated by a West German salesman into paying three times the going rate for cutlery. People were just happy they could finally buy things, but they had no idea how much things should cost, says Ms. Schneider. Recounting the tale 35 years later in a cafe in Dresden, a regional center of the former East Germany. That silverware scam lives on in three generations of Schneider lore. Ms. Schneider's brow wrinkles at the story of family indignity as if she'd been personally mistreated. People just took advantage during the reunification years. It makes me so mad. Today, a 28-year-old consumer, Ms. Schneider can buy whatever her budget allows. Yet, she finds herself choosing the stuff of the now-defunct GDR. that bright orange bread slicer, pastel-colored melamine bowls, a stark black veneer dining table. I just have this feeling that I want to bring back things that were seen as negative. It's empowerment to revive them in a better context, says Ms. Schneider, a social worker and influencer around all things East German with a 30,000-strong Instagram following. The Berlin Wall fell and landfills swelled with Soviet junk. 35 years after millions of East Germans tossed their Soviet-era stuff as quickly as dump trucks could haul it, young people who were not born when communist rule ended are finding joy in certain GDR collectibles. They're reveling in the pedestrian crossing symbols, Ampelmännchen, the plump little traffic light men, boxy Trabant cars, sleek Simpson motorbikes, and the bright blue clothing of GDR-era youth clubs. This gravitation toward symbols of a defunct state exposes cracks in German unity that were supposed to have disappeared along with the Berlin Wall. It's also a celebration of an East German identity that young people connect with. I'm not surprised at all that young people are consuming and presenting East German things. They're pursuing a collective identity that's different from the West and also a critique of the way reunification was pursued, says historian Justinian Jampol, author of Problematic Things, East German Materials After 1989. East German things have gone from being derided to collected to thrown away to exhibited. That ongoing process is a mirror and reflects just how much the history of East Germany is still conflicted, Dr. Jampol adds. East German goods were built to last. German youth might not use the word Ostalgie, constructed from the German words for East and nostalgia, yet many hesitate to discard an East German identity the West tried to crush during reunification, says Dr. Jampol. Their devotion to East German things is exuberant, but also respectful of clean design and construction that was built to last, says Benno Oras, 35, a social worker born in 1989. East Germany was a country where there was nothing or very little. Obviously, it was about making products that wouldn't break the day after tomorrow, says Mr. Oras. He still tinkers with his Simpson using 50-year-old GDR power tools that still work, he says. Respect, nowadays you see only junk which costs a fortune. People who collect GDR artifacts certainly aren't longing for the wall, the Stasi's secret police, or the communist regime, explains Katja Hoyer, a historian and author raised in East Germany. More than that, there's a personal history, and a family history that's connected to these items. It's your cultural product, something that gives you identity and roots, especially in times of uncertainty. A persistent economic divide certainly feeds nostalgia, as well as a sense, for some, that the past has been better or should be revived in some ways, says Johanna Kies, a political sociologist at the University of Leipzig. We are running out of time, so we'll wrap this up here. Thank you for listening to the Christian Science Monitor, read by April Lee.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.